Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled The Rhythm of Practice by Eric Weinberg. This Dharma Talk is about the music and grace notes of life and how Dharma practice creates the conditions to play it and hear it. Sources include His Holiness the 17th Karmapa, Daniel Brown, and Alan Wallace. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning, everybody. This is the Sunday Dharma Talk from Columbus KTC, and I'm Eric Weinberg. I'm a meditation instructor at the Sangha here. And this morning, I was asked to give a Dharma Talk. The topic that I chose, I call the rhythm of practice. It seems to me that it's the most valuable thing that I can say. I'm just an ordinary guy. I don't have any special ordinations or any special qualities, but I've been practicing meditation for a long time, at least relative to my own life, in like since 1974. And I met the Dharma more than 20 years ago, the Buddha Dharma. And I was reflecting back on all the experiences, and they're precious. But probably the most precious thing for me is just how an ordinary person like me can bring my life to meditation, bring it to the Buddha Dharma, and receive my life back from the Buddha Dharma. And I wanted to talk about that, how meditation practice and the view and sometimes the fruition, the blessing, the insight and wisdom comes through in daily life. Part of the issue that we all have is that we're dealing with what modern psychology has identified as our ego, which is simply, who am I? Our cognitive stuff, what our mind's doing all day, which comes down to, what am I aware of? Our values, what's important to me, our emotional states, which change all day long. How do I feel? Our spiritual outlook. What is of ultimate concern to me? And our moral outlook. How should I choose between this and that? Those confront us all day, every day, one moment after another. That's the psychological condition of humanity. And that is precisely what the Buddha addressed in the beginning. And he said the trainings he advised were in ethics and in meditation and wisdom. Ethics comes to this place of values. Meditation is, how do we make our minds a useful tool for living an ethical life? And wisdom is insight into the way things actually are without our prejudices and our preferences impacting on that. And doing things to benefit the way things really are and not to harm them. So this idea of having a rhythm of practice through our daily life is to look at all these things, really, and find ways to accomplish those goals of being helpful and not harmful. Meditation itself actually has three kinds of meditation. Every single one of them, every practice that you can find, has three kinds of things going on in them. There's this thing that I like to call cleaning up, and that's having a look at our reactivity to things. And, you know, we all deal with preferences. We have things all day long. We encounter things that we like and try to get more things that we like. And then there are things we don't like all day long. And we try to get rid of things that we don't like and try to avoid things that we don't like. And then there's the vast majority of all the things in our life which we're simply not aware of, and therefore have ambivalence or, you know, bewilderment about if we stumble upon them. And cleaning up has to do with realizing that the way we feel about things doesn't really impute any kind of reality to them. There could be music that we really dislike and want to change the channel on, which is fine, but somebody else really likes it. That's why it's on the radio. And then there's, of course, things that we do like, and we try to tune into those things. This cleaning up, though, is taking that projection of something being inherently good or inherently bad, taking it back and creating some space there so that goodness and wisdom can arise in that moment. Because sometimes we're in things that we don't like and we can't change the channel on. For instance, Jeannie and I, my wife and I, were on vacation a few weeks ago, and flying back home, our flight got canceled. There was nothing I could do to get out of the fact that I didn't like sitting in the airport for 6 hours just to find out that I was going to have to check into a hotel that night and not be able to get a flight home. I was there with that. And there were other complications, and that's the way life goes. I actually got a case of poison oak while I was on vacation, so I was kind of physically uncomfortable. Let's put it that way. It was painful. And sitting in the airport, it was probably the last thing that I would want to do. And that was actually the basis for this talk. I reflected back on that, and I can't say that I was, you know, a bright, shiny human through that experience, but by the same token, I was at peace, and I was happy. And I wondered how I did that. I really didn't have any magical trick to do that. I just was curious, and I looked at my own mind and wondered how poison oak in the airport for 6 hours, looking forward to a 6-hour plane trip, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, could possibly leave me in a state where I was at peace. And then I recognized that I've got this daily practice and it kind of this superpower that comes with that, to be able to drop a thought or any sensation, and give spaciousness to it and creativity to it. Well, that was what was going on there I don't know that I ever recognized it quite that acutely before. And I was very grateful to all my teachers and to the time, the luxury of time I've had in this life to practice and so forth, the whole thing. And I wanted to share that with you this morning. So that's where this idea of this talk came from, was this direct experience that happened just a few weeks ago. The way we usually start these things, and I think it's important that we do, is to chant the Buddhist refuge prayer, the four-line refuge prayer. That is actually an important part of the rhythm of the meditation day. So let's start this talk in that way. Sanje Chudong Soki Chognama Jang Chu Pardu Tatni Gyapsu Chi Daki Jinsu Gipe Sunam Ki Drola Penshir Sanje Druparsho Sanje Chudong Soki Chognama Jangchu Pardu Nagni Kyapsu Chi Daki Jin So Ki Peso Nam Ki Rula Pinchir Sanje Ruparsho. I want to say it the last time in English. For those of you who aren't familiar with the Tibetan. Until I reach the heart of enlightenment, I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. And I take refuge in the Sangha. That is to say, I take refuge in the nature of enlightened mind, which is actually my own heart. I take refuge in the teachings that by following them, I experience this awakened mind. And I take refuge in the Sangha, the community of people who have brought me along and who wish only for my liberation. And then it goes on, by accomplishing the six perfections. These are the mind states that naturally arise with practicing the Dharma, generosity, and the rest. The rest would be generosity, ethics, patience, joyful diligence, meditation, and wisdom. I vow to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So that gives us clear direction. Thank you. It turns out that that refuge prayer is a great thing to do, not just by rote, but, you know, to establish as a practice first thing in the morning. Because it gives us this basis for understanding things as they are. It gives us the basis for cleaning up. We have some kind of understanding that our minds might be doing something else. And once we understand that, we can let them go and pick up that which is truly helpful to ourselves and others. The other two forms of practice, so I mentioned cleaning up, there's growing up, and growing up has to do with recognizing that it's not all about me, you know, going through life, whether it's a pleasant day or an unpleasant day, occurrences that we appreciate or things that we don't appreciate. Growing up has to do with seeing things from multiple perspectives. And that is the foundation for compassion, really. Recognizing that that impatient guy who just cut me off in traffic and scared me is having his problems of his own, that he's completely not in control of, and therefore causing problems for me and for others. If I can take back that projection of whatever names I'm mentally or even verbally calling him, and have a little spaciousness, maybe I can say a little prayer for him instead of engendering all this enmity. And that's an important thing. So that's growing up. You can think about kids. You know, when you have kids, you have a baby, they're so cute, but it's all about me. I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, I need my diaper changed, or playing with other kids, you can't have my toy, or I want your toy and I'm going to take it and make you cry. And, you know, eventually you've got to grow up and you learn something about being in this world with others. The Dharma is an elegant way of creating the framework or a view that brings a very harmonious path through life, no matter what's happening. Our Tibetan teachers are great exemplars of this. They went through hell with the Chinese invasion, occupation, and so on. And they could have become, you know, guerrilla warriors, and that war could be waging on and on and on, but they didn't do that. They actually gave this horrendous thing space. And in that space, they brought the Dharma here, right here to the West. Without them, you wouldn't be listening to me and I wouldn't be talking. And if I were talking somewhere, I'd have something different to say that was probably not as beneficial. So all these things that we label as positive or negative, even things that are the worst, actually, if given space, if used to create space, can also create great opportunity for goodness, even the worst of conditions. And that's growing up. And then the third type of meditation is waking up. That's the one that most of us are aware of. That's what we do when we do shamatha, sitting meditation. We let go of a thought. We let our minds become more and more spacious and luminous. And equanimity tends to arise naturally out of that state. And insight tends to arise naturally out of that state. That's waking up. So the elegance of the Dharma is that it's given us some practices that actually simply in doing them trains our mind to work with this psychological reality that we are born with, we live with, we die with. And the theory behind it is simple, that our consciousness, the six consciousnesses, you know, the five sense consciousnesses, our mental, our cognitive, you know, activity, sit on top of something called the storehouse consciousness. This is the Buddhist psychology here. And in that storehouse consciousness, it's neutral. It's like a garden. It's the earth of our own mind, and we plant seeds there. And whatever we think, do, or say, everything we think, do, or say is a seed that we plant there. And then how we work with that, you know, what our senses are, what our consciousness is, well, those are the gardeners. And just like gardeners, they can't make anything grow. They can only create the causes and conditions for things to grow. And they can choose what kinds of seeds get planted. So it gets important that we want to grow nourishing things, delightful things, beautiful things, and maybe not so much poison oak or poison ivy or things that can possibly harm us or harm others. And we do, you know, that's the way our minds are. So when we indulge our reactivity, you know, our anger, our impatience, our judgmental nature, our jealousies, our willful ignorance and refusal to understand things as they are, etc., we're simply planting seeds in our own mind that will indeed grow, because when the causes and conditions are right, seeds grow. And, you know, if we get a garden full of noxious, poisonous plants, it's because we planted those seeds. If we get a mind full of noxious, poisonous thoughts, it's because we planted those seeds. Sometimes when you're very young, you know, seeds get planted in you, and that's where we get back to cleaning up meditation with recognition and sometimes counseling and other skillful work. We can still turn that garden into something fruitful and bring nourishing, sweet things to fruition. Might take a little extra work. Regardless, as adults at this time, it's our responsibility and nobody else's. So how do we live our life so that we're planting good seeds in this garden of our mind all day long? How do we create the causes and conditions for those good seeds to grow into a beautiful, nourishing garden, an inspiring garden? Well, beginning the day with a refuge prayer, recognizing that there are those that have gone before us that have that kind of mind, and they've shown us the way, and recognizing that there's really a large cast of characters that support us along that way. It's really important. It gives us kind of a framework and a confidence to go forward. What could be more compassionate than to start the day with that thought and the resolve to not do any harm to yourself or others with your body, physically, with your speech? And speech is, you know, how we relate to ourselves and relate to each other. It's with our self-talk and with the way that we talk to other people and with our minds. What kind of seeds are we planting in there? Are we building a case? So after refuge, we come to just a few moments. Doesn't have to be a long, arduous thing. Of shamatha, where we rest our mind on an object, usually our breath, because you can still be in bed. And as thoughts come up, you just get the mind used to dropping the thought, letting go of it. You don't have to make it go away. You let go of it the way you let go of a cloud floating through the air. I mean, you don't know where it came from and you don't know where it's going, and there's no stopping it anyway. So treating your thoughts like that, like the weather, and realizing that there's no need to engage them. And there's also no need to make stories about the thoughts or the experiences that come up. They are what they are. And you can drop the story as well. So when the Buddha said that the root of suffering is craving and clinging, what he's really talking about with craving is our preferences. So I like all those judgments and labels. Oh, I like this. I don't like that. We don't have to do that. That is not discriminating wisdom. That is not insight. Discriminating wisdom and insight are different than judgments and labels. So when we drop our judgments and labels, and this idea that things are this and not that and so forth, and create that spaciousness with the confidence that Buddha nature, that this awakened mind actually is within us, it can shine forth into that space and give us some insight. So we learn to drop our cravings, our preferences, our labels, our judgments. And we learn it again and again. The Tibetan word for meditation is gom, which actually means getting used to. I always thought that was interesting. We're letting our minds get used to its spaciousness instead of its overwhelming dizziness. And then we drop the story. That's the clinging part. If we don't drop the craving, obviously we have all these stories that justify how we feel and what we think and so forth. And we get lost in our own stories. You can hear it. It's also a developmental thing. You know, when you've got kids or you're around kids and they do something that's not quite harmonious, out of rhythm or out of step with actually who they are or who the family is or who their classmates are. What comes out next is the story or the excuse of why it is that way or why I had to do that, rather than a mature response, which is to drop the story and open up and listen. And if there's, you know, a requirement for repairing something that was broken, finding the best way to repair it. If there's no need for that, just letting it go and doing the next right thing. So that is waking up. And if we give ourselves a chance to settle into refuge, and then a chance to just remind our minds that we have this superpower of being able to drop a thought and drop the story about a thought, it becomes very powerful. There are additional things that also set us up for a good day. There's a prayer called the Seven Branch Prayer. And I'm not going to go through that just now and give a teaching on the Seven Branch Prayer, but it's those kind of things with those kinds of thoughts that give us good reminders of, give us kind of a tune of how we can look at our day. And there are like things available online and other places that are like seven branch prayers. They're long ones, they're short ones. I've got one here that actually incorporates the refuge prayer and the seven branch prayer. It's written by Lama Tony Duff. You can find it online. And it's called A Liturgy for Making the Daily Shrine Offerings Together with Samantabhadra's Sevenfold Practice. Very fancy name. So it starts with refuge. And then it goes to the first branch, which is called prostration. And I guess I am going to talk a little bit about this prayer. It's important. And the beauty of this is that you imagine that there are as many Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, you know, awakened beings and their sons and daughters, as there are atoms in the universe filling your space. And that even each atom within those presences, that awakened, enlightened energy, are full of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And you think about your life, what you have, all the goodness that you have, and you offer it to them. So you make prostrations with your mind. You just mentally offer your life to them. And then you make prostrations with your speech. You offer your relationships to yourself and to others to them, all in the hope that your day can be full of awakening, as opposed to planting poisonous seeds. And then, of course, you do the same thing with your mind. And you imagine that all the seeds you're going to be planting are going to be things that lead you to that same state of Buddhahood. And then there's the branch of laying aside, and you look at things that have come up, things that you worry about, things that could have gone better, things that were unskillful. And rather than running away from them, because life contains that for all of us, you acknowledge them and acknowledge that by bringing awareness and bringing growing, the aspiration to grow and the aspiration to repair and purify, to clean up, to all those things, that sooner or later you'll be able to do that. And you lay aside all the things that are dogging you and giving you a problem. This is a really important thing. Because I got a little quote here from the 7th Dalai Lama, I think. Where did I put that? I don't want to misquote him. Yes. Because what the 7th Dalai Lama said is, what is like a smelly fart that, although invisible, is obvious? He said, one's own faults that are precisely as obvious as the effort made to hide them. So it's really, really important to think to yourself, hey, I don't want to be a smelly fart today. And through setting my mind in the right direction here, I can avoid that. So this laying aside part is really, really important. It's a way of not trying to hide them away, recognizing things, and having the courage to think that just through your practice, just through your aspiration to goodness, you can clean that stuff up and you can make stuff better. The other thing is that follows that is to rejoice in all the merits of everybody who's doing any good. This is really important because we all get dogged by jealousy. That's actually something that, you know, we see somebody else is getting something we want or doing something we wish we could do or smarter than us, whatever. Naturally, if we haven't grown up to the point of Buddhahood, we probably will get jealous. So rather than hiding that away or just trying to bury it, recognize it. and recognize that at the same time, you also have awakened nature. You also have Buddha nature. And because of that, if you keep doing your growing up practice and your waking up practice and your cleaning up practice, you'll be able to accomplish the same things or even more. That's what I've heard from teachers that I admire. They always say, just keep at it. Just keep going. You'll do more than I ever did. That's what I hear from these people that I kind of put on a pedestal. And I shouldn't put them on a pedestal, except I do. It's not what they want. What they want is for me to accomplish what they've accomplished and accomplish even more. So as we say this kind of seven-branch prayer, we can rejoice in their merit. And by doing so, we're planting the seeds of aspiration in our own mind stream, in our own garden, that will someday, when the causes and conditions come together, the warmth and the moisture, whatever they may be, will surprisingly appear. And I think we've all had that happen to us one time or another. When you start to garden your mind intentionally, though, you're likely to get more and more of the kind of crop that is nourishing and healthful and beneficial. So that's rejoicing in all the merits, especially rejoicing in the merits of others. The last two branches are really asking for the teachers who can help us along the way to not leave us alone, but stay with us and bug us and point out what we need to know in order to make the next growthful step. And also, lastly, to dedicate all the merit, all the virtue, all the goodness for the benefit of awakening for ourselves and others. This doesn't have, it's a long explanation, but it doesn't have to be a long prayer. And I do encourage you to, you know, go online and look at some and find ones you like. The most important thing, I think, is to find stuff that's suitable for you, to meditate for the amount of time that's suitable for you, to start where you are, and then let it change as it changes. One of my own practices is I've done this a few times. I make a prayer book for myself that contains the things that I want to practice. So this is my prayer book right now. And I just keep it right by the place where I meditate, and I can pick it up. And no matter what kind of day it is, I can come to a place that feels like home to me, that feels comfortable and that pulls me along. You know, I've got stuff in here that stretches me a little bit, stuff that actually I can just sink into and relax a little bit, all of that. So one of the prayers that's in here is a very short seven-branch prayer, and I want to share that with you. And it goes like this: whatever merit I have gathered through prostrations, offerings, confession, rejoicing, requesting and praying, for the sake of the enlightenment of all sentient beings, all this I dedicate. It can be that simple. The idea is to have a reminder, and it's really good if it's a simple reminder, because you can carry that throughout the day. If it's too big and elaborate, unless you've memorized it somehow, you know, you're going to have to carry a book with you, or you're going to have to find a quiet space where you can be left alone for a minute to do something a little longer and a little more elaborate. That's not necessary. So if we start our day with just 5 or 10 minutes of mental hygiene, I like to call it that because it's a lot like dental hygiene. It's just, we brush our teeth every morning. It's what we do. It's good for our teeth. We can do refuge and shamatha and seventh branch prayer every morning because it's good for our mind. It makes our mind healthy, keeps our mind from rotting and being like a fart, you know, in the world. We just don't want to be that fart in the world. And I encourage myself and others, you know, when there's even a small moment during the day, to recall sitting on my bed in the morning when I get up and just sink into this training of my mind to regard life in that way and to set up the conditions for me to plant seeds with every thought, word, and deed in my mind stream that'll bring forth the kind of crop that I'm really looking for. So, you know, I used to be in an office where things were a little bit uptight and people watched when you weren't around or you were checked out for a minute. So, you know, nobody bugs you too much when you go to the bathroom. So sometimes, you know, throughout the day, I would just go to the bathroom, except I'd sit on the toilet and I'd practice for 5 minutes and then I would come back. We can all do that for ourselves and we can all do that for each other, almost no matter what our circumstances are, to the point where it just becomes your groove, your rhythm, where in the middle of a phone conversation or an intense meeting, actually these wonderful qualities become naturally available. And that's the sort of miracle that I think I experienced in that airport a few weeks ago. It's just, boom, it appeared. And isn't that how gardens are? You plant these good seeds and you don't really know when they're going to sprout. You water them if it's not been raining enough. And, you know, you try to not plant them in shady spots unless they're the kind of seed that likes shade. And, you know, you want it to get warmth and sunshine and all that kind of things. But you don't know when they're going to sprout. Well, the storehouse consciousness, the seventh consciousness, is like that too. It's just quietly doing its work. It's always doing its work, just like the earth is doing its work. The gardeners, these five physical senses and mental consciousness, have to do their work, but they can't make things grow. They can only create the causes and conditions for things to grow. And once you know that, you can make some kind of a strong aspiration to create the causes and conditions for goodness to grow in life. And then almost no matter what happens, you know, you can bring that forth. You can bring that about. Then at the end of the day, at night, you know, we can look back and we can see where we got all egocentric. And we can see where we allowed spaciousness, and from that, we were able to do something maybe surprising or just something that's pacifying or something that brings goodness and enrichment to people or something that brings people together or something that stops something bad from happening. We can look at, you know, having done those four activities what we call the four activities of the Buddha: pacification, enriching, magnetizing, and subduing. We can see where they naturally sprung up in the openness that we provided for them. And we can rejoice in that and dedicate the merit of that for the benefit of others who maybe even are some of the most aggravating people in our lives or that we know of, hopefully hoping that someday they too can be bringing these good things about in the world. And we can also see where we got egocentric and we kind of planted some noxious seeds or cut some smelly farts. And we can look at the causes for that and the conditions rather than just brushing them aside and apply this insight that we have to, you know, maybe even ask, request a Buddha or a Bodhisattva for advice about how to repair something that we damaged or how to make something better that we could have done better and approach it that way. And in that way, we purify things that dog us, that upset us about ourselves. And also, you know, you plant that seed of repair in your mind right before you sleep. And it's a powerful thing because in sleep, a lot of repair is happening naturally to your body and to your self-talk. That's part of what dreaming is all about, is working out the way we speak to our own minds. And we can carry whatever repair happens in sleep, if we start it that way, into the next day. So everything comes into rhythm, this rhythm of cleaning up, growing up, and waking up. And our lives, because of that, can become richer and richer, and the lives of others can be helped. And what more could anybody want, really? It always struck me that whether you're a Buddhist or a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim, the traditional religions all recommend that you pray, you know, multiple times a day. The Catholic Church has the hours of the office, and you know, they're like, I think 7 times a day, including through the night, there are certain prayers and psalms that are said. And Muslims pray 5 times a day. And there's a call to prayer in their culture, in their community. Jews pray 3 times a day, or 4, depending on what particular tradition you might be from. And I think this all comes to the same wisdom that there's a rhythm. And through prayer and meditation, we simply are making ourselves familiar with our own divine spark, our own Buddha nature, our own essence. And by bringing, you know, that to mind again and again, at the end of the day, at the end of our life, we've planted a lot of good seeds and we have, and a lot have come to fruition that's worthwhile and beneficial. A lot of egocentric behavior has been let go of. That's all that's necessary, is to let go with some kind of insight so that we can grow. That's cleaning up and growing up. So I guess it's important to say that, you know, all those efforts that we make, and all the efforts we don't make, they all wind up being seeds that are planted. And it's up to us what we plant. For me, it's always been helpful, very helpful, to have others to talk to about this, because I can get, you know, egocentric and self-involved and believe my own confabulations and conceptualizations when they're, you know, way off the mark. But when I've talked to meditation teachers over the years and I've shared with them honestly about what I'm doing and how it's going, they've been able to help me and give me some really, really good advice. And I think we need each other in that way. So I encourage you, if you're a member of a community, a member of a Sangha, to find companions on the path that you trust, who have a little experience and some commitment to the path, and use them and talk to them. Don't waste all your time talking about other stuff. You know, carve out some time for talking about this. I guarantee you it'll be worthwhile. If you have somebody who's been labeled a teacher available to you, reach out to them periodically and talk to them about what you're doing and how it's going. Because this garden of yours, the beauty of it, the nourishment of it, the helpfulness of it really depends on your skill as a gardener. And there's always more to learn. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, something cannot arise from nothing. We already existed before our birth, although in a different form. Clouds are the past life of rain. I love that. Clouds are the past life of rain. Rain is a continuation of clouds. When energy becomes matter, that is just a continuation. It's not that matter has been produced wholesale out of nothingness. The laws of physics and the teachings of Buddhism agree that something cannot be produced from nothing. In the same way, something cannot become nothing. It cannot completely disappear and cease to exist. When we burn a piece of paper, the paper does not cease to exist. It becomes heat, ashes, and smoke. Heat penetrates the cosmos. Smoke and other gases rise into the air and form clouds which give rise to rain. Ashes fall down to the earth and nurture the soil. Rain and soil are two of the conditions necessary for trees to grow. Later, the tree may become a piece of paper again. Looking in this way, we can see that even a piece of paper transcends birth and death. One of the things that we wrestle with is that everything is the nature of change. It's what the Buddha called impermanence. Everything is the nature of change. And how we respond to change really is the essence of these seeds that we plant in this storehouse consciousness. It's our response, our relationship, the rhythm of how we create the conditions, how to water enough but not too much, and so forth. Thich Nhat Hanh goes on to say, our mind is like a sword. It cuts reality into pieces, separate from each other. But reality cannot be grasped by our discursive mind. The mind of imagination, discrimination, and discussion. We have to learn how to touch reality without using our usual patterns of thinking. If we practice looking into the nature of interbeing of things, we can unlock the door of reality and let go of the notions of same and different, individual and collective. These are ideas that cannot be applied to ultimate reality. This ultimate reality is that all things change, and all things that arise, arise with causes and conditions. So our life, if you will, is to become mindful of the causes and conditions that we're creating and bring benefit to ourselves and others. That's it. And the easy way to do this is to establish this kind of rhythm of looking at life that way, of experiencing it directly that way. There's really, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, no way to think this better. All the books we read, all the papers we write, all of that, it can be good. It's good to learn things. I am not a Luddite in any sense. I like reading and thinking and studying, but we're not going to see reality directly in that way. That's just another piece of the gardening puzzle. It helps. It's a gardening tool, but actually directly seeing reality as it is, seeing the nature of our own mind as it is, our Buddha nature, is direct experience. And so, you know, by doing these practices that have been passed down and doing them authentically, as we've been taught, it's important to have a teacher. We may, in fact, be able to directly experience this thing that's called awakening or enlightenment. And there's no other way to do it than to directly experience it. In fact, there's no way to even put words around it according to the masters who have experienced it. All they can do is really point the way. And this is the way that they've pointed. Establish this rhythm of response to life in your mind. And then in some surprising moment, as Kempo Kartha Rinpoche said, one day you'll sit down on your meditation cushion, an ordinary person, and you'll get up an enlightened being. It's just like that flower that finally blooms. But you just don't know when, and you can't push that bloom. So that's about all that I wanted to share today. And I want to encourage everybody to give your life a little rhythm, not with a lot of stress. It's not like an athletic training event, but short periods of time of meditation, contemplation, reflection throughout the day. I think it'll bring happiness and kind of like the music to life, right in your own life. So thank you for listening. And if you have the inclination, I really encourage you to go to columbusktc.org and hit the donate button and help us. We're trying to rebuild our Dharma Center, which was burned down by an arson fire of a few years ago. And we need all the help we can get. And we appreciate every bit of it. So I want to take a moment, dedicate the merit of this gathering that we've had here to the enlightenment of all beings, to the health and happiness and wholeness of all beings. May all suffering be eliminated. May the causes of suffering be eliminated. May happiness flow everywhere and the causes of happiness be abundant. May people be at joy and peace. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.